through the senior class about her stunt with Charlotte in the girls' bathroom. Most kept their distance, went quiet when she passed, but a few took a different tactic. I love your hair. You have great skin. Your nails are amazing. Is that iron? Kate had even less patience for the would-be minions than the Charlottes. She'd seen people grovel at her father's feet, try to plead and con and worm their way into his graces. He told her once that it was why he preferred monsters to men. Monsters were base, disgusting things, but they had little interest and less talent when it came to gaining favor or telling lies. They were hungry, but that hunger had nothing to do with ambition.
I never have to wonder what they want, he'd said. I already know.
Kate had always hated monsters, but as half the school steered clear and the other half tried to make advances, she began to see the appeal. It was exhausting, and she was relieved when the last bell finally rang. Look, she said to Marcus when she reached the black sedan. Not expelled.
It's a miracle,
deadpanned the driver, holding open her door. Shielded by the tinted windows, she finally let the cold smile slide from her face as the car pulled away from Colton and headed home. Home. That was a word that took some getting used to. The Harkers lived on the top floor of what was once the Allsway building and was now known ostentatiously as Harker Hall, since her father owned it from sidewalk to spire. Marcus stayed with the car while two men in dark suits held open the glass doors and ushered Kate inside. Classical music wafted through the air like perfume, fine in small doses but quickly becoming noxious. The place itself was decadent. The lobby vaulted overhead, the floor a stretch of dark marble, the walls white stone with gold trim, and the ceilings awash with crystal chandeliers. Kate had read a sci-fi novel once about a shimmering future city where everything was glamorous on the outside but rotten to the core, like a bad apple. She sometimes wondered if her dad had read it too. If so, he'd obviously never read to the end. A dark suit fell in step behind her as she crossed the lobby, which was brimming with men and women in lush attire, many obviously hoping for an audience with Harker. One, a gorgeous woman in a cream-colored coat, tried to slip an envelope of cash into Kate's hand, but she never made it past the suit. Which was too bad. Kate might have taken the bribe. Not that it would have made it to her father. Instead, she kept her eyes ahead until she reached the golden elevator. Only then did she turn, survey the room, and offer the edge of a smile.
People are users. It's a universal truth. Use them or they'll use you.
Another line from Callum Harker's manual for staying on top. And Callum Harker had been on top, or at least on his way up, for a very long time. He was a man good at making three things. Friends, enemies, and money. Most of it illegal. Long before the phenomenon and the chaos, before the territory wars and the truce, he was already becoming a kind of king. Not on the surface, no. That title belonged to the Flynns. But all cities were icebergs, the real power underneath. And even in those days, Harker had half of V-City in his pocket. So when the shadows started growing teeth, when the neighboring territories shut the borders, when panic drove people out of the city and then the people outside the city drove them back, when everyone was terrified, Harker was there. He had the vision, had always had the vision, and then, suddenly, he had the monsters too. And it seemed so simple. Go with Flynn and live in fear, or go with Harker and pay for safety. And it turned out people were willing to pay a lot. The Harker penthouse was minimalist and sleek. More marble and glass, interrupted by dark wood and steel. There were no servants up here, no suits. Everything about the apartment was cold, full of sharp edges. No place for a family. And yet, they had been one here. They'd lived in the penthouse, all three of them, in those short months after the truce and before the accident. But when she dragged through her memories, searching for home, the images were all mixed up. Open fields and distant trees, broken glass and buckling metal. It didn't matter. She was here now, she would make it hers. "Hello?" Kate called out. No one answered. She hadn't expected a welcoming party. A, "How was your day, sweetheart?" They'd never been that kind of family. Her father's private office was attached to the penthouse, but it might as well be its own apartment, its own world. The massive doors were shut, and when she brought her good ear to the wood, she heard only a low and steady hum. Soundproofing. Kate pushed off the doors and turned back toward the rest of the loft. Beyond the floor-to-ceiling windows, the sun was just starting to sink behind the taller buildings. She tapped a panel on the wall and the lights came on, flooding the space with artificial white. Another tap, and the heavy silence was broken by music pouring out of speakers across the apartment. She kept her eyes on her father's office and held her finger down. The volume rose and rose until the sound vibrated in her chest and made the empty space feel full. Her steps were lost under the beat as she made her way to the kitchen, climbed onto a stool at the counter, and unpacked her bag. The Colton workload was daunting, but she'd spent years at boarding schools that seemed to have nothing better to do than assign homework. In among her papers was a handout on university preparations titled Life After Colton, filled with options, most inside Verity, but a few beyond. The borders had reopened 2 years ago on a heavily restricted basis. The territory was still a closed zone, under quarantine code 53, Other. But Kate imagined a few of the Colton kids had enough connections to get transport papers to go with a university invite. After all, the other territories wanted Verity's brightest minds. They just didn't want their monsters. She tossed the booklet aside. A stack of fresh medallions sat on the marble counter, heavy iron discs with the ornate V branded onto the front. Kate spun a pendant absently between her fingers. Iron. It was true that monsters loathed the stuff, but it wasn't the metal that bought safety. It was Harker. Anyone could hang a piece of metal around their neck and hope for the best, but these were special. The back of every medallion was engraved with a number, and every number was, or would be, assigned to a person. A ledger in her father's office kept track of every soul who purchased his protection from the things that waited in the dark. Not because the monsters feared the metal, because the monsters feared him. She snapped her fingers, spinning the medallion again, watching the two sides flash past over and over. No pendant, no protection. That was Harker's law. As the disc wobbled, she felt something move behind her. She couldn't hear it, not over the pounding beat of the stereo system, but she knew instantly in that hairs standing up on the back of your neck way that she wasn't alone anymore. Her hand drifted under the lip of the counter and closed around the handgun strapped against the granite. By the time the medallion fell, she was on her feet, the safety off and the gun raised. She looked down the sight and found a pair of blood-red eyes staring back. Sloan. 6 years ago, she'd come home to V-City, to her father, and found Sloan at his side, dressed in a tailored black suit. Her father's favorite Malachi looked almost human. He had Callum Harker's height, if not his build, and Harker's deep-set eyes, though Sloan's burned crimson where Harker's shone blue. But if her father was an ox, Sloan was a wraith. The dark bones of the skeleton just visible through the thin vellum of his skin. With his pallor, Sloan looked sick. No, thought Kate. He looked dead. Like a corpse on a cold day. An H was branded into the monster's cheek, just below his left eye, the letter the size and shape of a college ring. Her father wore it on his left hand, above his wedding band. Sloane's thin lips drew back to reveal sharp teeth, like a shark's, each filed to a point. Malachi, Malachi, sharp and sly, smile and bite and drink you dry. Sloan was saying something, but she couldn't hear his words over the blaring music. She didn't want to hear them. Sloan's voice was all wrong. Not a rattle or a growl, but something soft and cloying. She had never seen the Maokai feed, but she could imagine him, covered in gore, his voice still sickly sweet. "I can't hear you," she mouthed, hoping he would go away. But Sloane was too patient. He reached out and touched a panel on the wall with a single sharp nail, and the beat collapsed, plunging them back into silence. Kate didn't lower the gun. She wondered what kind of rounds were loaded. Silver? Iron? Lead? Something that would make a dent.
"Home for less than a week," he said, his voice so low in the wake of the music that she had to strain to hear. "And you've already found the weapons."
Kate smiled grimly.
"What can I say?" "Do you plan to shoot me?" he asked, taking a prowling step closer,
red eyes bright with interest as if it were a game. "I've considered it," she said, but she didn't fire, and then she felt a weight on the gun and looked down to see Sloane's hand resting casually on the weapon's barrel. She hadn't even seen him move. That was the way with Maokai. Slow until they struck. Sloane clicked his tongue against his sharp teeth.
"My dear Kate," he said, "I'm not your enemy."
His fingers slid forward, brushing hers, cold and slick, almost reptilian, and she jerked away, surrendering the gun. He set it on the counter between them.
"No problems today, I assume,"
Kate gestured to herself. "Home in one piece."
"And the school?"
As if he cared. "Still standing." The temperature in the kitchen was falling, as if Sloane were sucking all the heat out of the room. Kate crossed her arms. "You're up early."
"A vampire joke. How original."
He never cracked a smile, but Sloane had her father's dry humor. Only the Corsi were truly nocturnal, allergic to the light of day. The Maokai drank blood and drew their strength from the night, but they weren't vampires, didn't shrink away from crosses, wouldn't catch fire in the sun. A piece of pure metal through the heart, though, that would still take them down. Kate watched Sloane eye the stack of medallions on the counter and recoil ever so slightly before he turned toward the floor-to-ceiling windows and the thinning light. She had a theory about Sloane, that he wasn't just Harker's servant, but his Maokai, the product of some awful crime, an aftermath, just like those Corsi in the clip she'd watched. Something that slithered out of Harker's wake. But who had he killed to gain a creature like Sloane? And how long had the Maokai been there, at her father's side, when Kate wasn't? The question made her want to put a silver bullet through the monster's eye. Her gaze flicked to the brand on the Maokai's cheek. "Tell me something, Sloane." "What did you do to become my father's favorite pet?" The Maokai's face stiffened as if freezing into place. "Have you learned any tricks since I left? Can you sit, lie down, play fetch?"
"I have only one trick," he said,
lifting a bony hand to the air beside her head.
"I know how to listen."
He snapped his fingers next to her bad ear. Kate went for the gun, but Sloane got there first.
"Uh-uh,"
he warned, waving it side to side.
"Play nice."
Kate held up her hands and took a step back.
"Who knows?"
said Sloane, twirling the weapon.
"If you behave, maybe Harker will finally claim you, too."
Chapter 9. August felt like hell. Every one of his 418 tally marks was humming faintly by the time he slumped into the subway seat and closed his eyes. His pulse pounded in his head along with the steady, distant sound of gunshots. He tried not to think about it, but it was like trying not to scratch an itch.
"How could you?"
snapped a woman across the aisle. She was standing over a man reading a tablet. When he didn't look up, she slammed her hand down on the screen.
"Look at me! Damn it, Leslie! I work with her!"
Do you really want to do this right now? He growled. Fine, let's make a scorecard.
You are such an ass.
There was Eric and Harry and Joe. But are we counting the ones who didn't want you?
She slapped him hard. The sound was a crack in the subway car, a bang in August's skull. Heads turned toward the fight. He swallowed hard. His influence was spreading, radiating off him like heat. Two seats down, a man began to sob.
It's all my fault. All my fault. I never meant to do it.
You really are a bitch.
It wasn't worth it. I should have left. It's all my fault.
The noise in the subway car grew louder, and August gripped the seat, knuckles white, and counted the stops until the seam.
You okay?
Asked Paris when he reached her apartment. She had that extra sense, the one that knew when things weren't right.
I'm alive,
he said, swapping the blazer back for his FTF jacket. She reached out, brought a hand to his cheek. You're warm. His bones were heating up, his skin stretched too tight over them.
I know.
The cellar downstairs felt blissfully cool and dark, and part of him just wanted to lie down on the damp floor and close his eyes. But he kept going, through the tunnel and into the building on the other side, up and out, and four blocks south through the broken streets to home. In the elevator, he found his reflection and did his best to smooth his hair, compose his features. He looked peaked, but otherwise, the sickness wasn't showing yet. Henry was waiting for him in the tower.
August?
He chided.
You were supposed to text when you left school.
Sorry,
he mumbled.
Are you okay?
God, he hated that question.
I'll be fine,
he managed. It wasn't a lie. He would be fine. Eventually.
You don't look fine,
challenged Henry.
Long day, he muttered through clenched teeth.
Henry sighed.
Well, perk up. Emily's making a nice dinner tonight to celebrate your first day. That's ridiculous, he said. Three of us don't even eat. Humor her.
August rubbed his eyes.
I'm gonna take a shower.
He left the lights off in the bathroom, peeling the uniform away in the dark. The water came on cold, but he didn't turn it up. He stepped in and gasped as it hit his bare skin, shivering under the icy stream. He stayed until his bones stopped hurting, until the cold loosened the fire in his chest and he didn't feel like he was swallowing smoke with every breath. He leaned his forehead against the shower wall.
You're okay. You're okay. You're okay.
By the time he got out of the shower, the sun had gone down. Everyone was waiting for him in the kitchen.
There he is,
said Emily, wrapping him in a hug.
We were starting to worry.
His skin was still cool from the shower, so she didn't notice the fever. Still, he pulled free and made his way to the table. August cringed. The overhead lights were too bright, the scraping of chairs too sharp. Everything was heightened, like the volume on his life was turned up, but not in an exciting way. Noises were too loud and smells too strong and pain, which he did feel, too sharp. But worse than the senses were the emotions. Agitation and anger burned under his skin and in his head. Every comment and every thought felt like a spark on dry wood. The table was set. Two plates had food on them. The other three were garnished only by napkins. This was ridiculous. It was a waste of time. Why were they even trying to pretend, like...
Sit by me,
said Ilsa, patting the seat to her left. August sank into the chair, fists clenched. He could feel Leo's gaze on him, heavy as stone, but it was Henry who spoke.
So, did you see her? Of course I saw her,
said August.
And?
Pressed Emily.
And she looks like a girl. She doesn't exactly exude murderous kingpin.
Sure, she tried to, but there was something about the performance that rang false, like it was a piece of clothing. His own clothing felt too tight. August closed his eyes, a bead of sweat sliding down his back. He felt like he was made of embers, someone blowing faintly on the...
Anything else?
They were both looking at him so expectantly. August tried to focus.
Well, I think I might have accidentally made a friend.
Ilsa smiled. Leo raised a brow. Henry and Emily exchanged glances.
August, said Henry slowly. That's great. Just be careful.
I am being careful, he snapped. He could hear the annoyance in his voice, but he couldn't calm down any more than he could cool off.
You wanted me to blend in. Wouldn't I stand out more for not making friends?
I'm all for you making acquaintances, August, said Henry evenly. But don't get too close.
You think I don't know that?
The anger rose in him too fast.
Do you really think I'm that stupid? Just because you've kept me cooped up in this place for 4 years, you think I don't have any common sense? What am I gonna do, Dad? Invite them over for dinner?
He shoved up from the table.
August, pleaded Ilsa.
He heard his parents push up from their chairs as he fled the room, but it was Leo who followed him into the hallway.
When's the last time you ate?
He demanded. When August hesitated, Leo came at him. He cringed back, away, but his brother was too large, too fast, and he only made it half a step before Leo pinned him against the wall. He took August's chin in his hand and wrenched his face up, black eyes boring down into his.
When?
Leo's influence bled through his voice and his touch at the same time, and the answer forced its way out.
A few days ago.
Damn it, August,
said Leo, stepping back.
What?
He challenged, rubbing his jaw.
You go a week, sometimes more, and Ilsa doesn't even seem to need it. Why should I?
Because you do. This is a foolish, futile pursuit. You have a fire in you, little brother. You should embrace its heat instead of trying to dampen it.
I don't want. This isn't about what you want,
cut in Leo.
You cannot build up resistance by starving yourself. You know what will happen if you don't eat. All those precious little tallies will go away, and you'll have to start again.
But that wasn't what August was afraid of, and Leo knew it. It wasn't about losing the marks. It was about what he'd lose with them, what Leo had already lost.
How many are you up to now, little brother?
August swallowed.
418.
418 days,
echoed Leo.
That's impressive. But you can't have it both ways. You feed or you go dark. How many died last time you fell? 8?
The number clawed its way up August's throat.
9,
he whispered.
9,
repeated his brother.
9 innocent lives, all because you refused to eat.
August wrapped his arms around his ribs.
What do you want?
Chided Leo.
To be ordinary? To be human?
He said the word as if it stained his tongue.
Better human than a monster,
he muttered. Leo's jaw tightened.
Take heed, little brother,
he said.
Do not lump us in with those base creatures. We are not Corsi, swarming like insects. We are not Malkai, feeding like beasts. Sunai are justice. Sunai are balance. Sunai are
self-righteous and prone to speaking in third person,
cut in August before he could stop himself. Leo's black eyes narrowed, but his calm did not waver. It never wavered. He pulled out his cell and dialed. Someone answered.
Tell Harris and Philip to take a walk,
he said, then hung up. He drew a folded piece of paper from his pocket and pressed it into August's hand.
Go eat before you lose more than your temper.
Leo wrapped his fingers around the base of August's neck and pulled him close.
Pretend it's chicken,
he said softly.
Pretend you're normal. Pretend whatever you like, little brother. It does not change what you are.
And with that, Leo let go and returned to his place at the table. August didn't follow. He stayed in the hall until his heart settled. And then he went to find his violin. Chapter 10. By the time Harker's office door finally opened, the sun had gone down. The last echoes of light streaked violently across the sky.
Kate was still sitting at the kitchen counter, less out of academic diligence. Her homework was done, then a stubborn determination to be there when her father emerged. He'd been avoiding her all week, ever since the black transport had deposited her in the hours before dawn. That first goodbye, when she was five and the city was tearing itself apart, and Harker was bundling them into a car, and she was sobbing because she didn't want to go, he'd taken her chin in his hand and said,
"My daughter does not cry."
And she'd stopped, right then and there. But when she came back after the truce, the first words he said to her were,
"Make me proud."
And somehow, then, she'd let him down. Now Kate was here again, and this time she wouldn't fail. Charlotte's words rang in her ears. "He can't stand to look at her." But it wasn't true. He just didn't understand yet. She wasn't the little girl he'd sent away 12 years ago, the one who set bugs free instead of killing them and was afraid of the dark. She wasn't the girl who'd come back 6 years later, the one who cried when she had bad dreams and got sick at the sight of blood. She wasn't weak like her mother, wouldn't break down and try to vanish in the middle of the night. She was her father's daughter. Kate sat very still at the counter, her head turned so she could hear the sound of Harker's heavy steps across the paneled floor. She waited, listened as the steps moved away instead of toward her. Listened to the sound of the elevator being called, the scrape of its arrival, the hush of its descent. When it was gone, Kate got to her feet and turned to follow, only to find Sloane blocking the doorway. It was dark out now, and Sloane seemed more real, solid, in a way that put her on edge. His skeleton stood out like a bruise beneath his skin, and his teeth looked longer and sharper and silver as knife points.
"Hungry?"
Kate shook her head. "Where did he go?"
"Who?"
asked the Maokai, narrowing his red eyes. Surely he had better things to do than babysit her. His expression certainly said so. "Is this how Harker has you spending your time?" she goaded.
"Let's play a game," he said amiably. "You can tell me to get out of your way. You can call me a monster, and I can call you a sheltered little brat, and we can have a quarrel. It will be entertaining. Maybe when it's over, you'll even storm off to your room and slam the door like an ordinary teenager."
Kate gave him a cold smile. "I'm not an ordinary teenager." Sloane sighed.
"Would that you were.
Tell me where he..." Sloane shot forward, caging her in against the counter. The sudden force of it was like a blow to the ribs, knocking the air from her lungs. "Down, dog," she snarled, trying to keep the fear out of her voice. The Maokai didn't move. His crimson eyes dragged over her.
"Can't you see?" he whispered. "Harker doesn't want you here."
"You don't know that."
"Of course I do."
A single cold finger came to rest against her cheek. The nail was filed to a point. She swallowed, held her ground. "I am not a child anymore."
"You will always be our little Catherine," he murmured, "crying herself to sleep, begging her mother to take her away."
"Mom wanted to leave, not me."
"You can lie to yourself, but I can't."
A drop of blood welled above Sloane's nail, but she didn't pull away. "I am a Harker," she said slowly. "I belong here. Now tell me where he is." The Maokai sighed and turned his gaze away, considered the thickening dark beyond the windows.
"In the basement."
Kate swallowed and started toward the elevator.
"But you really shouldn't go there."
The doors opened. Kate stepped in and turned back toward the Maokai. "Why not?" He flashed a savage smile.
"Because that," he said, "is where the real monsters are."
Harris and Philip joined August on the way down. The elevator paused at the 15th floor, and the two brawny guys in black fatigues climbed in. Harris was 18, dark hair spilling out beneath his cap, and Philip was 20, buzz cut, and like most of the young men in South City, they'd apparently jumped at the chance to join the FTF. They were both cheerful guys, the kind to get a bounce in their step at the first sign of trouble, to run toward it instead of away. The kind to high-five after taking out a Corsi with an HUV beam to the head or driving a metal spike through a Malkai's heart.
So, we're on level 3. You know that corridor, the one where the cameras don't quite reach and... Oh, hey, August.
Saved by the elevator, said Philip.
He flashed August a warm grin.
You holding up?
August nodded tightly. The anger was bleeding out of him, which wasn't a good sign. What came after was worse.
You look like you could use a boost,
said Harris, pulling off his FTF cap and settling it over August's black curls. Only a few hand-picked members of the FTF knew who, and more important, what, August really was.
I was just telling Phil about this prime.
She's out of your league, bro.
Harsh.
No,
said Philip as they hit the lobby.
I mean, she is literally out of your league. Second-class team captain, and you're a what? Didn't you just get bumped back to mindless drone?
Harris rolled his eyes.
What about you, August? Good-looking Mons,
Philip shot him a look.
Kid like you. Anyone special?
Believe it or not, said August as they stepped out into the night. My options are limited.
Nah, you just gotta expand your parameters. Look beyond your...
Philip cleared his throat.
Who are we visiting tonight?
He asked, scanning the street. August shifted the strap on his shoulder. He'd moved the violin into a different case, one that looked like it was made for a weapon instead of a musical instrument, and unfolded the paper Leo had given him. It was a profile. A victim. August tried not to use that word. Victims were innocent, and this man was not. But the term kept getting stuck in his head.
Albert Ossinger, he read aloud. 259 Faring Pass 3B.
That's not too far, said Philip.
We can walk.
August considered the paper as he fell into step behind them. A grainy photo was printed below the words, a capture from a video feed. Sometimes people brought cases to Henry Flynn, looking for justice, but most of the targets came from the footage. South City had its own surveillance, and Ilsa spent most days scanning the feeds, searching for shadows other people couldn't see, ones that shouldn't be there. The mark of someone whose violence had taken shape. A sinner. Corsi fed on flesh and bone. Malkai on blood. And whose it was meant nothing to them. But the Sunai could feed only on sinners. That's what set them apart. Their best-kept secret. It was the seed of Leo's righteousness and the reason all FTFs were required to be shadow-free. It was also why, in the early days of the phenomenon and the mounting chaos, Leo had chosen to side with Henry Flynn instead of Callum Harker, a man with too many shadows to count.
We are the darkest acts made light,
Leo liked to say. August supposed they were a kind of cosmic cleanup crew, created to address the source of the monstrous problem. And Albert Ossinger had officially been labeled a source. The boots ahead of him came to a stop, and August folded the paper and looked up. They were on the corner of a gutted street, most of the lights dead or flickering. Philip and Harris had their HUVs out, beams slicing back and forth on the pavement. They were looking at him expectantly.
What?
Philip cocked his head. Harris jabbed a finger at a building.
I said we're here.
The apartment building looked run down, 5 stories of chipping paint and cracked brick. Broken window glass littered the curb where it had been bashed out and boarded over using iron nails. A nest, that's what they called places like this, where people burrowed down as if waiting out a storm. There was no telling how many people were holed up inside.
You want us to come in?
Asked Harris. They always offered, but August could tell they'd rather keep their distance. The music couldn't hurt them, but it would still take its toll. August shook his head.
Watch the front.
He turned to Philip.
And the fire escapes.
They nodded and split up, and August made his way up the front steps. A metal X had been fashioned across the door, but it wasn't pure, and even if it had been, it wouldn't have stopped him. He pulled an access card from his coat pocket. An FTF tool, skeleton-coded. He swiped it, and inside the door, a lock shifted. But when he turned the handle, the door barely moved. Stiff or barricaded, he didn't know. He put his shoulder into the metal and shoved, felt the bottom lip scrape the floor for several grating inches before finally, suddenly, giving way. Inside, the stairwell itself was a mess of boxes and crates. Anything that could be used to help hold back the night if it found a way in. UVR lights glared down from the ceiling, giving the hall an eerie glow, and a single red dot flickered in the corner. The security cameras in South City were all wired into the same closed grid, but August still pulled the FTF hat down over his eyes as he climbed to the third floor, the violin slung over his shoulder. Sunai, eyes like coal, sing you a song and steal your soul. He could hear voices through the walls, some low and others loud, some distorted, television or radio noise, and others simple and real. When he reached 3B, he pressed his ear to the door. The hungrier he got, the sharper his senses tuned. He could hear the low murmur of the TV, the floor creaking under the weight of steps, the bubble of something cooking on the stove, the inhale-exhale of a single body. Ossinger was home, and he was alone. August pulled back. There was no peephole on the door. He took a deep breath, straightened, and knocked. The sounds in 3B stopped abruptly. The footsteps stilled. The TV went dead. And then a bolt slid free. The door opened, and a man peered out into the hall. Too thin in a half-buttoned shirt. Behind his back, his shadow coiled. Behind his shadow, the room was a maze of towering paper and books, half-collapsed boxes, bags of trash, clothing, food, some of it rotten.
"Mr. Ossinger," said August. "May I come in?"
When Albert Ossinger met August's eyes, he knew. Somehow they always knew. The man paled, then slammed the door in August's face. Or tried. August caught the wood with his hand, forcing it inward, and Ossinger, in a panic, turned and ran, toppling a stack of books, pulling over a shelf of canned food as he scrambled to get away. As if there were anywhere to run. August sighed and stepped inside, closing the door behind him. Chapter 11. The elevator doors slid open, and the veneer of wealth fell away. Up above, Harker Hall might be all veined marble and gold trim, but down here in the basement, there were no polished floors, no glittering chandeliers, no soothing Bach. Those were just layers, the waxy skin of the apple. This was the rotting core. The basement of the Allsway building housed an event space. A decade earlier, a bomb had stripped the pain and taken the lives of 17 people, but left the steel and concrete bones intact. And it was here, the echoes of terror still ghosted on the walls and soaked into the bare floor, that Callum Harker held court. Not with his citizens, his subjects, but with his monsters. Kate hung back, watching from the bank of elevators. The basement lights had all been directed away from the walls and toward the center of the massive room, spotlighting the raised platform in the middle. In the darkened corners, dozens of corsi gathered. All around the basement's edges, the monsters rustled like leaves, or debris. A death rattle in the shadows, a hoarse chorus of whispers, their voices coalescing from many into one. Beat, break, ruin, flesh, blood, bone, beat, break. They were nightmare creatures, the stuff of bedtime stories gone wrong. The things that lurked under the mattress and in the closet, given life and teeth and claws. Be careful, parents told their children. Be good, or the corsi will come. But the truth was, the corsi didn't care if you were careful or good. They swam in darkness and fed on fear. their bodies sick, distended shapes that looked human only if you caught them out of the corner of your eye. And by then, it was usually too late to run. Kate looked straight at the nearest one, focusing until her eyes adjusted and she could make out its milky pupils, its shadowed edges and sharpened teeth. Almost impossible to kill. A blast of sunlight to the head, anything less just dispelled them, but you had to find the head for that to work, which was harder than it seemed when their edges ran together, blurring in the dark. The Corsi had a hive mind. He ruled them all or none, and somehow Harker had bent them to his will. Apparently he'd lured them down into the underground and cut the lights, but what happened next was story-made legend. Some said it was his fearlessness that had cowed them. Some said he'd rigged the sprinklers with liquid metal, and when the Corsi had finally recovered, days, weeks later, they bowed to him. Harker's Malkai stood closer to the action, skeletal arms crossed over their dark clothes and eyes burning like embers in their gaunt faces. Most looked male, a few vaguely female, but none of them remotely human. They seemed to radiate cold, leeching all the heat from the air. Kate shivered, remembering Sloane's icy grip. And each and every one of them bore the same brand, an H on their left cheekbone. Nearby, a Corsi got too close to one and it hissed, flashing row after row of jagged teeth. Men and women dotted the crowd, thugs with hardened bodies and scarred cheeks, their very presence a show of strength. But next to them, the Malkai looked far more monster than human. The only things missing from Harker's collection were Sunai. Those rare creatures, the darkest things to crawl out of the phenomenon, had aligned themselves with Flynn down in South City. Some said the Sunai refused to be controlled, while others said they refused only to be controlled by Harker. Either way, Harkers were many and Flynn's were few, and their absence didn't make a dent. Everywhere Kate looked, the basement was brimming with monsters. Every set of eyes, white, red, or ordinary, focused on the platform and the pool of light, and the man standing at its center. Callum Harker had the kind of face that cast shadows. His eyes were deep-set in blue. Not light blue or sky blue or gray blue, but dark cobalt blue. The kind that looked black at night, paired with an aquiline nose and a severe jaw. Tattoos, bold tribal patterns snaked out from under his collar and cuffs. Black ink trailing onto the backs of his hands and tracing up his neck. The sweep and curl ending just below his hairline. Harker's hair was the only part of him that didn't fit. It was fair. A warm, sun-kissed blonde, like Kate's, that swept across his forehead and trailed along his cheeks. That one feature made him look like a cow. But only Kate's mother, Alice, had called him that. To everyone else, he was Sir. Governor. Boss. Even Kate thought of him as Harker, though she made an effort to call him Dad. The way his face twisted. Discomfort? Disdain? Dismay? Was its own kind of victory. Harker wasn't alone up on the platform. A man was on his hands and knees before him, begging for his life.
"Please, please,"
he said in a shuddering voice.
"I'll find the money, I swear."
Two Malkai hovered at the man's back, and when Harker motioned, they wrenched the man to his feet. Their nails sunk into his skin, and he let out a stifled cry as Harker reached forward and took hold of the metal pendant that hung from the man's neck.
"You can't,"
he pleaded.
"I'll find the money."
"Too late." Harker tore the pendant free.
"No,"
cried the man as one of the Malkai holding him yawned wide, revealing rows of jagged teeth. He was about to sink those teeth into the man's throat when Harker shook his head.
"Wait."
The man let out a sob of relief, but Kate held her breath. She knew her father, watched as he considered the metal and then the man.
"Give him a head start,"
he said, tossing the metal aside.
5 minutes.
The monsters let go, and the man crumpled to the floor, clutched at Harker's legs.
"Please,"
he cried.
"Please, you can't do this."
Harker looked down coldly.
You'd better start running, Peter.
The man paled, and then he scrambled to his feet and stumbled down off the platform and ran. The crowd of men and monsters, held quiet by Harker's command, now burst into noise, laughing and hissing and jeering as they parted to let the dead man through. A few peeled away from the group and followed him toward the concrete steps that led up to the street, into the dark. Back on stage, that's what it really was, a stage, a performance. Harker held up an iron walking stick, its grip shaped into a gargoyle like the one on the front of their car. Cult leaders, Cade had read in that same book, had a flair for the dramatic, the pomp and show. Now, rather than raise his voice to quiet the crowd, Harker drove the pointed end of the walking stick down against the concrete platform. The sound reverberated through the basement and the crowd fell to whispers, the murmurs sinking from a wave into an undercurrent.
"Next," he said.
Kate's eyes widened as a Malachi was dragged up onto the platform. The monster twisted and writhed, strength dampened by the iron chain circling his wrists and throat. Where his brand should have been, there was a patch of ruined skin, as if he'd clawed the mark away.
"Olivier,"
said Harker, his voice carrying across the event space.
"You've disappointed me."
"Have I?" snarled the monster, his voice a rasp.
"It is we who are disappointed."
A ripple went through the basement hall. "We." The Corsi rattled and the Malachi began to whisper.
"Why should we starve because of deals you make, human? We did not make such deals ourselves. The Corsi may speak as one, but the Malachi are not yours." "You're wrong," said Harker,
bringing the iron gargoyle up beneath the Malachi's chin, smiling as the monster recoiled at the metal's kiss.
"I give each and every one of you a choice. Stay in North City under my command, or go south and be slaughtered by Flynn's. You chose to stay in my city. You chose to take my mark. And then you chose to bleed a family dry. A family under my protection."
The Malachi's eyes burned angrily, but Harker's calm smile never faltered. He looked up and addressed the cavernous space.
"I have a system. You all know what happens to those who disrupt it. Those who follow me reap the rewards, and those who defy me," Harker looked down at the Malachi, "die."
The crowd began to rile again, nervous energy and violent excitement, while the Malachi strained against his bonds. Even monsters feared death. At least the Malachi didn't beg, didn't plead. He only looked up at Harker, flashed his sharp teeth, and said,
"Come near me and I will rip your throat out."
Harker took a casual step back and turned away. A table stood near the edge of the platform, littered with a variety of weapons, and Harker ran his fingers over them, considering his choices.
"Hear me,"
growled the Malachi behind him, his voice echoing through the hall even as his throat burned beneath the iron.
"We are not servants. We are not slaves. We are wolves among sheep, monsters among men, and we will rise. Your time is ending, Harker,"
roared the Malachi.
"Our time is coming."
"Well," said Harker, selecting a blade,
"yours is already here."
He drew the knife from its sheath, and Kate saw her chance.
"I'll do it,"
she called out, loud enough for her father to hear. The crowd stilled, searching for the source of the words. An elevated strip ran like a catwalk between the elevators at the back of the hall and the platform in the center, and Kate stepped out of the shelter and into the light. She kept her head up, focused on her father instead of the crowd, and caught the vanishing shadow of his surprise as it crossed his face. She'd been hoping for pride, but she'd settle for that. He considered her for a moment, clearly dissecting her move. Ostentatious, public, brash to the point of brazen. And they both knew he'd either have to welcome her involvement or punish her insolence. A dangerous play, and one she might pay for later, But to her immediate relief, he smiled and gestured to the table of tools as if it were a banquet.
Be my guest.
Kate strode forward slowly, confidently, every inch aware of how important it was to keep her emotions in check, her nerves in control. She mimicked her father's cool smile as she made her way toward him, careful not to look down at her audience. When she reached the platform, Harker brought a hand to rest on her shoulder and squeezed. A small, unspoken gesture, not of warmth, but of warning. And then he stepped aside to watch.
"What is this?" hissed the Maokai in chains. "You send a child to dispatch me?" "I send my daughter," replied Harker coolly. "And if you think that's a mercy, you don't know her."
Kate smiled at the praise, even if it was an act. She'd show him. She could be strong. She could be cunning. She could be cold.
"Send me a girl," said the Maokai, "and I will return a corpse."
Kate kept her good ear toward the monster, but pretended not to hear. She considered the table, her back to the crowd. Her fingers danced across the objects as she pictured the smooth bone plate that ran down a Maokai's chest in place of a sternum and ribs. She'd done her homework. Those who didn't know better tried to drive a weapon through the bone shield, pierce it with bullet or blade.
"Any time now, little Catherine," said the Maokai,
and Sloane's words shuddered through her.
"You will always be our little Catherine."
Kate's hand closed around a crowbar. It took more force than a blade, but the length would act in her favor. She took it up by one end and dragged it casually off the table, letting it scrape, metal on metal, drawing out the moment the way Harker would. She took up a knife as well, then approached the monster. Her fourth school, Pennington, had a zero-tolerance policy when it came to fighting, but the others had paid off. Back at Fisher, she'd taken karate. Then kendo at Layton, fencing at Dalloway, kickboxing at Wild Prior. St. Agnes didn't have anything like that, but they were big on quieting the mind, allowing room for God. Or in Kate's case, for focus. Kate twirled the crowbar. The basement went quiet.
"Lean in, pretty," said the Maokai. "Show me your throat."
Kate thrust the hilt of the knife between the monster's teeth and drove the crowbar up and under his ribs. There was a wet sound and the grind of metal on bone, and then the Maokai shuddered horribly, retched a mouthful of black blood onto her shirt, and slumped. Kate lowered him onto his back, and his red eyes gazed up at her, dull and dead. She drew the crowbar free with a slick scrape, then strode back to the table and returned the weapons carefully to their places, leaving a trail of gore in her wake. And then she met her father's gaze and smiled.
"Thank you," she said. "I needed that."
Her father raised a brow, and she thought she saw the barest flicker of respect before he gestured to the basement.
"Want me to find you another one?"
Kate considered the hall, still crowded with silent, shocked faces, burning eyes, coiling shadows.
"Thanks," she said, wiping her hands. "But I have homework."
And with that, she turned and strode out of the basement. When the steel elevator doors closed, she caught sight of her reflection. She was still in her school uniform. Her face was dotted with blackish blood, her shirt front and hands slick with it. She met her own cold blue gaze and held it as the elevator rose up through Harker Hall, floor after floor, until it reached the top. Sloane was nowhere to be seen, and Kate wove silently through the empty loft to her bedroom and closed the door behind her. Her hands were shaking as she tapped the radio on and turned the volume up, 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 until the sound vibrated off the walls of the room, drowning everything. And then, only then, safe beneath the sound, did Kate sink to the floor, gasping for air.
Chapter 12.
The first time August killed a man, it was entirely by accident. He'd come to, then born, manifested, at the school, with the black body bags and the worried woman who tried to shield his eyes as she pulled her coat around his narrow shoulders and loaded him into a car. The car took him to a building where other children were being collected by their families. But he didn't have a family, and he knew with a strange, bone-deep certainty that he shouldn't be there. So he slipped out through a back door and onto a side street. And that's when he heard the music. The first beautiful thing in an ugly world, as Ilsa would say. The song was thin, unsteady, but loud enough to follow, and soon August found its source. A weary-looking man on a packing crate, wrapped in a ratty blanket. He was tinkering with the instrument, and August made his way toward him, wondering at the man's shadow, which stretched behind him on the wall, moving even when he didn't. It had too many hands, too many teeth. And then the man beneath the shadow held the instrument up to the light.
"Who throws out a violin?" he murmured, shaking his head.
Back at the building, they'd given August a pack of cookies and a carton of juice. The food tasted like white noise on his tongue, so he'd shoved the rest in the pockets of the woman's coat. Now he dug them out and offered them to the stranger. It must have tasted better to the man because he devoured both and then looked up at the sky. August looked too. It was getting dark.
"You should go home," said the man. "South City's not safe at night."
"I can't go home," he answered.
"Neither can I," said the man, dropping the violin.
It made a horrible sound when it landed, but didn't break.
"I did a bad thing,"
he whispered as his shadow writhed against the wall.
"I did such a bad thing."
August knelt to retrieve the instrument.
"It'll be all right," he said, fingers curling around the wooden neck.
He didn't remember what happened next. Or rather, he did, but it was a set of photos, not a film. Stills without the space between. He was holding the violin, running a thumb over the strings. There was light. There was darkness. There was music. There was peace. And then, there was a body. And sometime later, there was Leo, who found him sitting cross-legged on the packing crate, fiddling with the strings, while the corpse lay at his feet. Mouth hanging open and eyes burned black. It took August a long time to understand the vital thing that had happened in the gaps.
"Mr. Ossinger,"
he called now, stepping into the cluttered apartment. His violin case caught on a teetering stack of papers and sent them sprawling in his wake. Across the room, Albert Ossinger was fighting his way up a narrow set of stairs so crammed with junk he almost couldn't pass. August didn't bother trying to follow. Instead, he shrugged the case from his shoulder and clicked it open. He withdrew the violin with practiced ease and nestled it under his chin, his fingers finding their positions. He exhaled, brought the bow to the strings, and drew the first note. The moment August began to play, everything eased. The headache loosened and the fever calmed. The tension went out of his limbs and the sound of gunshots in his head, which had become a constant static, finally ceased as the melody slid out and twined through the room. The music wasn't loud, but August knew it would reach its target. Beyond the chords, he could hear Ossinger's footsteps overhead drag to a stop, and then reverse, no longer frantic, but slow and even. August played on as Ossinger descended the stairs in measured steps, the music reeling him in. The song dipped and rose and spiraled away, and he could picture the people scattered through the building, their bodies dragging to a halt as they heard, their souls rising to the surface, most of them bright but untouchable. August's eyes were still closed, but he could feel Ossinger in the room with him now. He didn't want to stop playing just yet, wanted to finish the song. He never got a chance to finish. But the sickness was still rolling through him. So he let the melody trail off, the sound dying on the bow as he raised his head.